Here are the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch. First, Wisconsin and Illinois are reporting over a dozen cases of severe lung disease tied to vaping in teens and young adults, some of whom required intubation. Investigators are still gathering data on the types of vaping products used. Next, researchers have proposed a simple way to handle direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, in patients with atrial fibrillation undergoing elective procedures. Their strategy? Stop the DOAC a day or two before the procedure and then restart it 1 to 3 days afterward, depending on how risky the procedure is. This approach led to low rates of bleeding and thromboembolism, and it didn't require heparin bridging or preoperative coagulation function testing. Elsewhere, the leaders of seven U.S. medical organizations joined together this week in a statement on gun violence. They assert that, quote, "The medical profession has an obligation to advocate for changes to reduce the burden of firearm-related injuries and death on our patients, their families, our communities, our colleagues, and our society," end quote. And rounding out the list, the American Thoracic Society has issued new guidelines on obesity hypoventilation syndrome. Among other things, the group recommends positive airway pressure during sleep for stable patients. And that's it for this week. Now on to Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
Hematuria, what's the best approach to evaluating it? Using a 100,000 patient simulation, Dr. Matthew Nielsen and his colleagues compared the approaches of five guidelines. They compared the guidelines' abilities to detect urinary tract cancers along with the costs, hazards, and complications of each approach. Some guidelines, namely the Dutch and Canadian, recommend cystoscopy and ultrasonography. Others, from Kaiser Permanente and the so-called Hematuria Risk Index, or HRI, recommend different combinations of cystoscopy, ultrasonography, CT urography, or no further evaluation on the basis of risk factors. The final approach, the American Urological Association's guidelines, recommends cystoscopy and CT in all cases. Dr. Nielsen is in the Department of Urology, where he is an associate professor, and the Department of Epidemiology, and the Department of Health Policy and Management, all at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Nielsen.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Tell us a bit about the microsimulation approach that you used on this cohort.
Microsimulation modeling is a way of doing a computer simulation where we can do essentially a very sophisticated thought experiment, synthesizing evidence from different sources to create sort of a virtual world where we could play out hypothetical alternative scenarios. And in this instance, we took data from the two largest cohorts of patients undergoing evaluation for hematuria screening, a cohort of patients from Kaiser Permanente and a cohort of patients from the UK. And these cohorts were chosen because they had very, very detailed information about the patient's factors associated with cancer risk in terms of the patient's age and gender and other factors, and also detailed information about which types of cancers were detected. And this was important for our purposes because we wanted to be able to, A, take a representative sample of patients undergoing evaluation for hematuria and choosing these two populations from the largest series published we felt was representative, and B, we wanted to be able to gather some insights into what the relative advantages and harms of different approaches were with the different guidelines that you just described. And so, starting with that patient data from the UK and the Kaiser study, we were able to develop a sort of virtual world where the outcomes of the different testing strategies could be compared to each other.
Okay, and these were all adults and all had at least microscopic hematuria, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and some had gross hematuria.
Yes, they did. And that's a place where our study tried to add a little bit more to what has already been put out in this space. So one place where our study was a slight difference from the prior studies was trying to look more globally at the population of patients with hematuria.
Okay, so it's more real world. The most successful approach that you discovered was the one offered by the American Urological Association. And that's the approach in which if you've got hematuria, you're going to get cystoscopy and a CT. And you estimated that in that 100,000 cohort, there would be, according to incidence studies, there'd be about 3,500 cancers found. And the American Urological Association, or the AUA, approach missed about 2% of them, whereas Kaiser missed about 4%.
So it's certainly true that from the perspective of cancer detection, the most intensive approach detected the most cancers. The question is the relative advantage gained with increasing levels of intensity. The AUA detected 97.7%. The Kaiser guideline detected 96.7%. It was about a 1% difference, 3,432 in the AUA guidelines, 3,399 in the Kaiser guideline.
But there was a fly in the ointment, wasn't there? Or maybe actually more than one fly. So to get those good numbers of cancers found, you're paying in other disadvantages. Can you talk about those?
So what we found was that given the imperfect sensitivity of diagnostic testing, no approach detected all cancers. And as you pointed out, the detection rate for the AUA strategy was not 100%. And so, how high can we push that, and what are the relative costs of that, and also what are the relative harms associated with that? And what we found was that the total cost for 100,000 patients undergoing the AUA evaluation was estimated about $94 million, and the total cost for the other strategies, the HRI, was about $60 million, the Kaiser was about $50 million, and the Dutch and Canadian were $44 and $46 million. So the cost in terms of the amount of diagnostic testing, and so really just focused on that immediate episode of care, the most intensive approach cost the healthcare system around $94 million relative to $44 to $60 million for the other strategies. And then the other factors that we looked at in the study were harms, and specifically focused on estimates of the potential for CT scan to induce future cancers with radiation exposure from that CT scan.
Now that we're banging on the AUA, on CT actually, not on the AUA, the costs are greater, the number of cancers, I'll get back to that in a second, but the false positives are much greater than the other approaches. And one of the problems with CT is that the radiation doses delivered aren't consistent from one place to the next. And so the more radiation you're delivering, the more likely you are to be causing a cancer. So there are many things arguing against the use of CT, aren't there?
Yeah, and I appreciate you your statement at the beginning of that, saying that the exercise here is definitely not intended to be critical of or banging on the AUA's approach per se, because I really believe reading that document and knowing sort of where people are coming from there, I believe that the intention of really trying to not miss cancers, to maximize diagnostic certainty, the rationale underlying it, I think is very clear.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the harms that we tried to look at in this paper are things that have only recently become more salient to us, thinking about diagnostic testing and the way that we approach problems. A lot of the things that we do, there are more ripples, after that pebble hits the pond, there are more ripples than just what happens in terms of, did we or did we not make or miss any diagnoses. And with the CT scanning in particular, the radiation harms have become more salient. The false positives were an interesting one for us because there's actually very little data on practice patterns associated with false positives in this context. And so we did not go so far as to sort of speculate on how those would have been managed, what the costs would have been. The other one that we did not include estimates for, but that I think is very real, is the incidental findings. And with true positive test results in terms of the upper tract cancers that we're talking about being less than 1% of the population, the number of false positives is going to be higher. And the number of incidental findings with high resolution CT of the abdomen and pelvis is really high. You know, it's in, you know, one in three, one in four scans. And there's actually sort of an interesting unintended but curious observation, you know, when we ended up going through this work was, you know, one of the sort of true positive findings per se, the renal cell carcinomas, historically have been considered to be hematuria-associated urinary tract cancers. And historically, patients with renal cell carcinoma would present very dramatically with paraneoplastic syndromes and large abdominal masses and gross hematuria. But in the last few decades, that has become much different, with the vast majority of patients presenting asymptomatically with incidentally detected small renal masses. And what we found when we looked at, you know, what we derived from the two largest cohorts of hematuria patients undergoing evaluation was a prevalence of renal cell carcinoma of about 0.4%. So 443 out of the 100,000 patients had renal cell carcinoma. And that matches almost perfectly to the rates of renal procedures and nephrectomy in a large population of Medicare patients undergoing chest and abdomen CT imaging for all indications. So abdominal pain, shortness of breath, sort of you name it, around the same amount, around 4 in 1,000 patients underwent some sort of downstream kidney procedure. And it sort of raises questions whether the renal cell carcinomas detected in this setting might actually be no different than the renal cell carcinomas incidentally detected when people are getting CT for other indications.
And the final insult to the CT intensive approach, let me call it, is that it caused more cancers than its advantage over other approaches.
Right, and it's laid out in the table of the paper, and the very nice accompanying editorial sort of walked through those numbers a little bit.
Yep.
Again, I think getting at this question of, you know, where is that sweet spot? Different arguments could be made for any of the approaches. You know, the way that the sort of Canadian and Dutch approaches are laid out, there's no radiation-induced cancers.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, again, you know, bearing in mind that a lot of the cancers incrementally detected by using CT were these renal cell carcinomas, and some of the uncertainty about how many of those are really clinically meaningful versus just incidental findings is, you know, a controversial topic, but, you know, something that sort of puts those numbers in a little bit of a different context. And then the Kaiser and risk index approaches, where a subset of higher risk patients with a higher pretest probability got CT scan, there was a fair jump of the cancers detected, and particularly among the upper tract urothelial cancers, which are the smallest subgroup of all of these, you know, less than 100 in 100,000 patients. But those are the ones that I think drive a lot of the imaging because they are tough to find other than with CT, and they behave badly. And so I think, you know, people, you know, clinicians are very, very nervous about missing those, more so maybe the 1 centimeter renal mass. But, you know, there's sort of arguments to be made across the continuum with, you know, whatever the sort of implicit value judgment is. And I think one of the hopes that we have with this work is that laying this out, recognizing the limitations of this and recognizing that the estimates for radiation-induced cancers can be debated. There are some different assumptions in the model, but fundamentally there's a very strong evidence base that patients who receive radiation exposures in the range of common CT scans are very likely, you know, at a risk of potentially crossing a threshold into a risk for future cancer. And so what we are trying to do with this work is make some of those implicit value judgments a little bit more explicit. So we can say, you know, with approach A, we say that these are the things that we value most strongly, and this is the rationale for choosing them. With approach B, you know, et cetera. And potentially paving the way to patients getting more involved in the process and having more shared decision making. We've done a little bit of work, not directly involved with this paper, but talking with patients. And it's a tricky space because I think, you know, some patients are very engaged and really want to participate in the process. A lot of patients really trust that their doctors are making individualized decisions for them and balancing risks and benefits in every decision that's being made. And some patients are overwhelmed and anxious when presented with, you know, trade-offs where, on the one hand, we may have a slightly higher chance of missing a cancer. On the other hand, we may have a slightly higher chance of causing a cancer from the radiation. And so it's not clear, I think, at this point what the best way forward is. But with this work and, you know, work that others have done in the space, we're hopeful that getting people thinking a little bit more about the trade-offs and value judgments that have historically been much more implicit and trying to lay those out a little bit more explicitly will hopefully get us to a better way of doing it.
We covered your paper in Physicians First Watch, and so we conducted a poll. I don't know whether you saw it, but this is the question that we asked. In your current practice, do you routinely order CT for adults with microscopic hematuria? And we got 1,200 responses. And wow. you'll be glad to know that the overwhelming majority, 77%, said no, they don't routinely order CT, and only 23% said that they do.
One of the things about this topic area that is sort of the elephant in the room, and that is not directly addressed by our paper, is that this is a space where there's a very real interface between primary care physicians and secondary care urology physicians. And the focus of this is, you know, patients who are referred and go through the evaluation process, essentially on the downstream secondary care end of this, with the imaging obviously could be ordered by whoever, you know, primary care physicians, specialists, etc. The cystoscopy is a fairly specific procedure that urologists do, but there is a large body of literature suggesting that there's a lot not known about the triage process on the primary care side. Even with around 2 million patients a year being referred to urologists for evaluation of hematuria in the U.S., the total number of patients with hematuria is probably 5, 10, 20-fold greater than that, based on observational studies in terms of the number of patients with hematuria and the number who undergo evaluation. So I think that one of the caveats to this work and one of the things that I think is an opportunity for future improvement is increasing that dialogue between primary care and secondary care urology in this instance to really figure out, you know, making certain that those triage decisions aren't missing opportunities, you know, people who might benefit from a more intensive evaluation, and trying to minimize the number of patients going through evaluation with less potential advantage and benefit from it.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dr. Nielsen, for taking the time during your vacation to talk with us about your paper.
Thanks so much, Joe. I really enjoyed it, and appreciate the First Watch picking up our work.
That was our 228th Clinical Conversation. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Let us know how we can improve these chats. Email me, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.